Okay, I'm here at the headquarters of the British Horse Racing Authority with the Chief Executive, Nick Rust. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this, Nick. We just start right from the beginning, really. You've been in the racing industry all your adult life. What sparked the interest in that in the beginning?
Well, I one Saturday, about 6 stone ago, I was playing semi-professional football as a 14-year-old. Through my school and with Berwick Rangers as well, and for some reason our game wasn't on, and my dad said, "What are you going to do today?" And I think I said something sullen like, "I want to spend time with my mates on Woolworth Steps down in the town." So my dad said, "No, you're coming. You're being dragged along to Kelso Races," as he put it, and I went along with a form analyst, as I knew him to be. He was really one of my dad's colleagues at work who was into his racing. I was a bit sullen, got dragged along, but he took me down to the bookies. Because I love maths, I sort of was intrigued by the chalkboards and the odds and the prices, and he explained it a bit to me. And I remember that my dad and this chap, David, went off to watch the racing, and suddenly, from being a sullen teenager, well, I was probably still that, the sky became coloured in, I could smell the horses, I fell in love with it really that day. So it was really the numbers on the bookies' boards that sparked my interest, and you know, I started betting a little bit on the horses, underage, of course, at that time. And my love of the sport grew from there.
I think it's safe to say that in your career, you've been a flyer. I mean, started from the very beginnings as a cashier.
I've taken a flyer.
But what drove you to be, you know, to be such an achiever? Because it's fairly difficult to come from the very bottom to the very top.
I think... I don't know, I think I failed at college. I got kicked out. I spent most of my time at Ealing College, and my wife Margarita was studying in Newcastle. I think I spent more time in Newcastle and more time at Kempton Park, Newmarket and Sandown than I did at Ealing College. And I remember turning up for an exam, a law exam. I was studying economics and accountancy, actually. Turning up for an exam and thinking, when the invigilator said, "Turn the papers over," thinking, why am I sat in this room? I haven't been to any of the lectures. Why has it not dawned on me? Why have I been deluding myself? And of course, I quite rightly got kicked out after year two. I flew my exams in the first year without doing any work and thought it was dead easy. Year two caught me out. And I think from then, my mum and dad were, "Well, what are you going to do with yourself? You've failed." I think my dad was seen by my mother as someone who hadn't fully achieved. And here I was repeating the sins of the father, so to speak. Although I love my dad very much, he wasn't a huge high achiever in his work. And I just thought I'd better get on with this, better do something. And I was working for Ladbrokes as a board marker at the time in the summer, in the days before the screens were there, and I applied for a job with Ladbrokes. And I guess I just wanted, in those early years, and perhaps even until quite recently, I wanted to show my folks that they were wrong writing me off at that stage.
So would that path still be open, do you think, these days?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I think from betting into racing, it's hard. I got very lucky, moved into the job here. I mean, you know, I went from one dream industry into, you know, another part of my dream industry. I think that's hard to achieve. You know, it's going to be limited to a few, obviously, for a senior role like this. But there's no reason why people can't work their way through. And you see many, many great people working in the betting industry, be it on course or in the betting shops or indeed in the many online businesses now. Fantastic, innovative people who work hard and make their own luck. I think people can work their way through.
So if my research is correct, you were involved in the early days of online betting.
Yes.
There was quite a bit of transparency all of a sudden. Was that a real aid to the layers to see who were the winners and who were the losers?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was more involved in the operational side, building the websites, customer service. I think in the old days at Ladbrokes, and we weren't the first on the scene, but about 1999, 2000, you know, the orders were still coming through a web link but being printed off locally, you know. That's how much technology was involved. But yes, it gave more transparency, it gave more issues as well to manage particular customers. Suddenly you had the whole world trying to get on when your price was wrong. The early controls on the internet to manage that business weren't as sophisticated as they are now.
So with that sophistication, do you personally feel that the bookmakers these days are a bit too liberal with a restrict dial?
I think they're doing it for good business reasons, but I think... look, gaming obviously is a big part of the profits of online and bookmakers, and indeed in retail bookmakers as well. And a lot of, you know, if you can have a customer who spends a majority of their money on gaming, then that's likely to be more profitable than one who doesn't, and who sticks to sports betting. So I think they were looking for, have been looking for a particular profile of customers over the last few years. And I think sometimes that means that, you know, patterns emerge about a particular bet or a particular punter, and you can get put into a category quite quickly with some of the algorithms that are in play. I think bookmakers will have to work a bit harder at that over the next few years because the restrictions that are now going to come on, or likely to, on fixed odds betting terminals, but also the scrutiny online as well, means that I think betting operators will have to look more at their bookmaking skills and finessing it a bit more than perhaps an algorithm spotting a pattern and coming down quite hard on customers when a profit can be made from them across the piece.
Okay, so would you, modest staking punters that are even modestly successful, should there be a lower limit for why you, when you start restricting people?
Well, look, it's not, I'm not in the business anymore, and it's for others to decide for their own businesses, but I think we can see there are examples of companies who do not restrict so much, who are benefiting from wider business. And you know, you've got to make sure you have your hand on the tiller in the right way. Some companies are betting to very low margins and are happy to have customers who are only in their eyes generating 1 or 2% margin. Others are looking for customers at 10% plus, but some do it successfully at lower margins and can manage the balance of the fact that you may have some customers who are very profitable on racing but lose money on football and spend a little bit on gaming. And I think that further level of sophistication and confidence is coming into some firms and will need to across the piece for those that want to survive.
Okay, we'll get the contentious issues done, the FOBT debate. What is your personal opinion on fixed odds betting terminals?
Well, this I like playing them, and you know, I enjoy playing them very much, and perhaps because I'm very fortunate that I earn very well. You know, a £2 stake on roulette, which is what's being proposed in some quarters, would not provide me with the necessary thrill. You know, I want 10 or 20 quid on, or whatever it may be. But there's no doubt in my mind, having operated these for a number of years at Coral and then Ladbrokes. The first time I was at Ladbrokes, we didn't have them, they didn't exist. But in my later years, before I joined the BHA, I operated them, and I was acutely aware that a proportion of the money generated through these machines is coming from people who are identified or could be identified as problem gamblers. And another chunk of it is coming from some money laundering. So I think the betting operators recognize that, but you know, there's so much more that needs to be done. And I think that there need to be more controls. So the government is acting, the betting operators are also acting. Perhaps they've been a bit slow to respond. But more controls should be in place to make sure that people can control their gambling. And if that means lower limits, which I think quite clearly it means lower than £100, but to what level they go to, if it means lower limits, that's got to be one of the effective ways of managing things for people.
Do you think there's a risk that eventually the bookmaker's going to say, hold on a minute, this has got nothing to do with horse racing, why should we give you any from the FOBTs?
Well, we don't earn directly from the machines. We earn a percentage of profits on horse racing, so 10% of anything that's won on horse racing in the betting shops is paid over, the same online. But betting shops, there's no doubt that betting shops are probably open in larger numbers at the moment because machines do exist at the levels that they are. If there is a restriction coming, then it's likely to mean some betting shops close. And actually, British Racing earns about £30,000 to £35,000 in media rights from every shop that stays open. So we don't earn directly, but our business model at the moment, the racecourses who hold the rights, the rights holders have built their business model with betting shops on the basis that they will sell a fixed fee, or broadly a fixed fee per shop. So a decline in shop numbers will hit our profitability in the short and medium term. I think the clear thing is to say, well, where is the value going to be in the future, and that we need to adjust. And quite clearly, there are more and more people betting online now. About 60% of turnover on British Racing from British customers is now digital. higher proportion of profit comes from the shops because of the margins there, but people are voting with their feet and betting online, and that's where the rights holders need to earn their money. So I think there will be a move away, if you want to put it in those crude terms, I wouldn't use those terms, but there will be a move away from earning from the shops and the FOBTs naturally through an adjustment of media rights.
Okay, from a professional point of view, you reached the top of the bookmaking industry. Why did you decide to change direction?
Well, I didn't quite reach the top, and so I was at operations director type level, and I sat on executive boards. But yes, I enjoyed that very much. I worked my way through, enjoyed it very much. But then the chance to come and make a difference in British racing, when I was already a racing fan, I was lucky enough to have some shares in racehorses. And I just loved going racing whenever I could. The chance to come and be the chief executive of the British Horse Racing Authority was something I couldn't miss. I still pinch myself every day about it. It's a tremendous privilege.
When you took on your current role, what did you consider to be the most pressing problem with racing?
Funding. So the levy, which had stood the sport in good stead for a number of years, was likely to generate £50 million, compared with a high of about £120 million 10 years ago. And that was directly a result of the fact that the levy did not cover any offshore betting. So pretty much all of digital betting was not covered. Betting shops were losing share, so the levy money was dropping to racing, and we were struggling to continue to run the extent of an industry that provides betting opportunities 362 days a year. So that was needed, and probably one other thing, which is, and unfortunately we persuaded government and that loophole has now been closed, but the other thing was really around people and making sure we had enough capable people to look after our horses. We need about a workforce of about 7,000, and we're about 500 or 600 short. That remains an issue for us. Another issue for us now that we need to focus on very much is equine welfare and perceptions of equine welfare. So we're speaking now very shortly after the Cheltenham Festival, and we lost, unfortunately, we lost 6 horses. Each one of them a tragedy at Cheltenham, which is too many to lose. It's a rate above that we accept as an average. And fatality rates have been falling over the years. They've fallen by over a third in the last 20 years through equine science improvements, through race course improvements, improvements to the design of the fences and so on. But we have to keep on improving. So we've announced a review, and we're looking at all of the factors that contributed to 6 equine deaths at the festival, and we want to learn lessons and make improvements. So with government constantly focusing on animal welfare now, and it's high, even higher on the agenda than ever, our sport can take nothing for granted on that. So we have to put practical improvements in, and we have to continue to work to educate the public on it. That's probably the biggest challenge now.
So you're an owner, so you have first-hand experience of being an owner. So do you consider that they get a good deal from UK racing?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I mean, I feel so fortunate to be an owner. I went up to a racing yard in 2005, introduced by a friend of a friend, who said to me, "And do you think you'd be interested in taking a share of a racehorse, Nick?" And it was like Pavlov's dogs. I couldn't really say no. I found a way to make the payments, and fortunately, the first horse I was involved in that I had a third share in won on his third run for us at Sedgefield, and I've just been bitten by the bug. So I think that whole experience, most owners don't have an experience of owning elsewhere to compare. So that experience for me was fantastic. I had a winner early on, great. And the whole feeling of being part of a stables, part of the racing industry, fantastic. I think we're improving on the experience, but obviously the returns to racehorse owners here are considerably lower than in other countries where there are, well, frankly, where there are much better returns from betting, I hate to say. In France, where there's almost a monopoly on betting through the state-run operator, which invests a heck of a lot of its money back into racing. And in Ireland, where 1% of turnover is taken on all betting activity, not just horse racing, they can afford to fund the sport better than the central funding in Britain. So at the moment, if you own an average horse in Britain, you can expect 8 pence in the pound cost recovery. from your outlay. We think with the additional prize money going to a record level this year of £160 million, with an extra £16 million being injected at middle and lower levels, we think that number might improve to 12 or 13 pence. So, you know, it is an improvement. But, you know, it's a luxury purchase getting involved in a racehorse, even if you've only got a fraction of a horse, and people can buy in for as little as £20 a month in some syndicates and take part in this. And I think that's a fantastic way to try it out. And if you're fortunate enough to be able to afford more, yeah, I think you get a great deal from British racing in terms of the prestige, the involvement and the buzz you can get from it.
Do you feel that the British horse racing pays enough attention to what goes on at the exchanges, especially at lower grade meetings? And do you feel that heavy laying of horses near the off and the consequential misbreak or uncompetitive run should be investigated as seriously and publicly as misdemeanours actually on the course?
Well, the answer to your second question is yes. We have a close link with Betfair already, and many of the we have a data link on an anonymised basis where we can see patterns of behaviour, and we work closely with them to identify issues. Could we do more in terms of investigating the apparently more minor issues? Yes, I think we can. I think we recognise that. I announced with my colleagues a stewarding review in August because I wanted to improve the standards and modernise the standards of stewarding for the future. And this is one of the areas. Are we asking enough questions on a racecourse? And because of the way that we're set up, very often the same people who ask the question also have to make a decision in terms of discipline on a race day. And there's only so much time on a race day, the way we're currently set up. So, you know, we're probably finding that on average we're not asking enough questions. And sometimes by just asking the question, that can act as a bit of a deterrent as well. So we've got much more to do on that front, but we don't ignore it. But I would say our consistency and frequency of asking the question is not yet sufficient.
Okay, thank you. Still talking about bookmakers. Recently, it seems to have been open season on racecourse bookmakers, criticised from all angles when they bet to a margin considered too high, etc. But they don't seem to get any support and sympathy as their expenses soar, and their racecourses are facilitating easy access to the internet to compete to them. Do you think that racecourse bookmakers are supported and recognised as an asset to the UK racing industry as they should be?
Probably not enough. I mean, this is probably a Ben question, right? They're probably not enough. I think, you know, it's difficult to sort of present a case that gives sympathy from a consumer point of view to betting to 160% when you can use your mobile phone and bet to 6 or 7%. It's hard to sort of argue for that. However, you know, I think that racecourse bookmakers offer a service. They offer a service to the betting industry as well, by returning SPs and providing shows of betting and so on, which we need. And perhaps it's a case of looking at that relationship again and seeing how they are, if you like, remunerated on the way through. Traditionally, the ring was so strong and there was no opportunity to bet off course that, well, frankly, bookmakers were clamouring to pay their way and you know, were very competitive. Now, things have changed, the nature of the market's changed, and we need to look and see what tomorrow's betting ring looks like.
And then we've got the other contentious issue at the moment, the anomaly of the jockey's whip rules. I mean, a jockey can break the rules, win a top race by a short head, and get fined and banned, but the horse keeps the race and the connections and backers profit. Surely the horse race is the only sport where it's okay to break the rules and still win.
Well, I mean, the last bit's often said, but of course you can break the rules in football, get sent off and your team still plays. And there are other examples like that. This is a very tricky one. Generally speaking, the whip rules are very, very well adhered to. We have, however, in our very top races, we have a higher proportion relative to the number of races of those rides being above the limit, the so-called ride at all costs. We had Richard Johnson in the Gold Cup with Native River. He struck the horse 13 times. Now, that's well over our limit. Some people say, why are you bothering with that, Nick? The ride looked fine. Is Richard a serial offender? No. Did he get carried away with it? Yes. Is it acceptable? No. But how do we deter that? So he already got a 7-day ban for that and a £6,500 fine. We could jack those up and look to deter even more. What I will not sanction, because I don't think it's right, is many people are saying, well, disqualify the horse. Well, I put it to you this way. Imagine it wasn't the Gold Cup. Imagine it was, I don't know, Catterick on a Wednesday afternoon for a £5,000 race. And there'd been some interesting betting activity, perhaps well masked, that a particular horse was not going to win. And the horse was a form favourite. And the jockey thinks, well, I'll hit it 12 times because I know I'm going to get disqualified. We could not have a rule where it would be so easy to get a horse beaten that you simply had to hit the horse more often and count beyond a certain number. That would not work. So it leads you to much, much tougher penalties, continuing education, perhaps bringing in some of the top racers on a hands and heels basis. I know that some of the purists in the sport will go about that, but I think we need to continue to evolve this, and we have to stamp out this culture of riding at all costs, which, as I say, is very limited, but it's still happening too often for our liking.
It's fair to say that you've stopped the firms, the big bookmaking firms, getting away with murder, not paying the levy on their offshore horse racing profits. Are the exchanges in your sights?
Well, I think it's there's two things about the exchanges. One is to make sure that the regulation that we have in horse racing, that we have a good communication with them to prevent some of the integrity issues that we talked about earlier. But the key thing for me is that you know, the law has, if you like, determined very clearly how Betfair should make payments in terms of tax. Betfair and the other exchanges should make payments in terms of taxation and levy, and it's based on a share of the profits that they make. I don't think we're seeking a change to that. It would deliver an unsustainable business model. I think it's interesting that a number of the exchanges are effectively going back into sportsbook models, and that they're working their business back into sportsbook. So a customer like me that might only have generated a little bit of commission on the commission on losses, you know, I'm someone who loses money betting on football. Then why would you want to share that with a third party punter when you can have the profit for yourself? So you're starting to see those firms moving their business into fixed odds betting, and that ends up meaning that they end up paying levy at the same rate as the other bookmakers. So we're not particularly out to change the model for exchanges.
Going on to the actually attendance at the race courses, obviously a lot of courses do put a lot of effort in to get different sorts of people in, you know, music nights, family fun days, etc. Does the BHA have any particular different plans to try and attract a more diverse crowd to horse racing?
We set up a diversity in racing group last July or August, after a report from Women in Racing was published, which they commissioned through Oxford Brookes University, looking at diversity in the sport. And our sport has a long way to go, like many others. Although we have a good record in some things, for example, 40% of tickets purchased in advance for race meetings are purchased by women, compared with 20% is the highest in any other major sport in this country. We clearly have an issue with non-white faces at race courses and throughout our sport, competing in our sport. And I think what the group, which is drawn from across our sport and outside our sport, and looking at gender, ethnic background, disability, etc., we are looking to put out a plan in April with a clear plan, which is trying to ensure that we can bring role models through and encourage people to come through in our sport. And we've agreed that we will call out bad behaviour wherever we see it, but there's no place for that. I think there's been some interesting stories that we've been fostering over the last few weeks about the Liverpool MBA student who, as part of her work, introduced a paper looking at the capability of female riders versus male riders, and basically saying that if you filter out the quality and capability of the horse being ridden and you adjust for that, then women ride as well as men. A fascinating study with 14 years of data, and we've started to talk about that a lot, and there's been a lot of discussion about female riders over the last few months. You know, could they win the big races more frequently? Could they even win the championship? I personally think that it is possible that we may have a female rider win the Flat Jockeys Championship in the next 5 years, if Josephine Gordon or one of the others coming through. So it's great that we're talking about those things where our sport hadn't before, and I think the role of the diversity group is to create those discussion points and to put in place some practical measures to help break down barriers.
Okay, thank you. Now, everybody has responsibilities. Some own a business responsible for many people, but you lead an entire industry in sport. How do you cope with the pressure of making decisions that you know will affect people both positively and negatively right across the game?
Well, I lead the BHA and we play a part leadership role in the sport together with others. As I say, I'm privileged to have this role. Look, I have a great passion for the sport and its people. I love going to training yards. I love seeing the horses in training at the racecourse, seeing the way the whole industry works, and particularly how our people look after the horses and make this sport work. Making decisions in that context is an easy thing to do because hopefully I'm trying to, with colleagues, make decisions for the right reasons. Can never please everyone all the time with regard to that. But you've just got to make the best decision in line with the strategy, and as long as you're open and you can explain your decision, not everyone will like it, but you know, as long as people can respect that you made it for the right reasons.
Now, you've been a senior figure at some of the world's biggest bookmakers, you now run the BHA. Have you got anything else you want to achieve within the industry?
Well, I mean, I love this job and there's so much still to be done. You know, I've made mistakes since I've been here. We have made progress on a few things together, but there is so much more to achieve. I really want to stay here and continue to help British racing hopefully improve and grow. And, you know, I'm excited right now about the resolution to the levy, because every year, either with my old hat on in betting or with my newish hat on in racing, every year we would be fighting about the levy, how much it was going to deliver into the central funding of racing. That is now solved for the next 7 years, and I've been really encouraged to start having conversations with bookmakers where we can work together to grow betting on the sport. So right now, although we've got other priorities that I mentioned, that is really exciting me, because I think we are growing betting on racing in this country again after a long-term decline and against the trend in other countries, and I want to see if we can do even better over the next few years.
Follow our top sporting brand ambassadors Davy Russell, Sylvester D'Souza and Ryan Sidebottom for their exclusive news, views and tips on all the major events with blogs and vlogs at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org, over 18 only.